Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. You know the drill. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea behind the show is pretty simple. No matter where you live in this great country of ours, there's a hero in your hometown. There's somebody who is willing to put his life on the line for the freedom that you and I enjoy every day. So we want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way in this hour conversation, hopefully you'll hear a thing or two maybe you've never heard before, something that makes you love your country even more and really respect our greatest generation. We're going to visit with a member of that generation today, Louis Davis, 87 years old, of Clovis, California. He served in an anti-aircraft battalion in a battle that I know you've heard of before, Iwo Jima. But before we get to the Pacific, let's start out in the frigid north of Minnesota, where you grew up, or maybe I should say Minnesota. Make sure I say that a little better. You can say it for me. Is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Sure was. I was there, and I was sitting in the living room, and a couple of kids were playing some ball down the block a bit. And so I ran out there to play with them, and they came flying at me, and they said, "Did you hear about what happened at Pearl Harbor?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. What's that?" You know, I had no idea. I did know what Pearl Harbor was as a Navy base, but that's all I knew. And then they filled me in on, you know, how many ships had been hurt and sunk and all that. But I never expected to, you know, to know anything about it other than, you know, that a naval base.
So you're 17 years old at the time. How did that news hit you? And did it occur to you, you know what, this might have something to do with my future here?
Not really. The only thing I remember is that I was very surprised, of course. And then we began to listening to the radio, and the people were saying that, oh, we'll be able to knock them out in, you know, 2 weeks, and that kind of dumb stuff. And we kept on getting pieces of information and pieces of information. And, you know, by nightfall, we had a pretty good idea of, you know, we had been hurt badly in the Hawaiian Islands. And then we heard that, they were fighting in the Philippines and some of those smaller islands out there, that my next-door neighbor was on Wake Island, and he was captured and put in POW. Camp for several years. He has the scars. Well, he had the scars. He passed away a short time ago.
This was your next-door neighbor there in Minnesota, or your next-door neighbor here?
Next-door neighbor here. Him and his wife had a home next door to us.
Well, yeah, when you hear a story like that, it certainly adds some perspective to it. Do you remember hearing FDR's address when he listed the damage? And what did that mean to you as a teenager at the time to hear your president rattling through everything that happened, but at the same time rallying the country to try to go take on that threat?
It impressed me because, you know, I wanted to go and sign up immediately. But my folks said they wouldn't do it, and so I understood that. And they called me down a little bit, so I didn't. But I did desperately want to go in, and I waited. Then I waited until I was drafted in June of 43.
So you had wanted to enlist, they talked you out of it, and then you waited till you got drafted. Was there any point during that time where you thought, you know what, now that I'm 18, I'm going to go sign up, whether they want me to or not? Is that something you toyed with, or you had too much respect for mom and dad?
Yeah, I had too much respect. I didn't want to, you know, put oil on the fire, so to speak. I could see that my mother was, you know, just hanging on by a thread. She didn't want me to go, period, but she relented.
And you're in a small town just outside of Minneapolis, right?
Yeah, St. Louis Park.
How different was that town a year or two after the Pearl Harbor attacks? Were you seeing all the young men head off to do something?
Oh, yeah. There's one of the benefits that happened was that we were able to get jobs as soon as we got out of high school, or even while we were in high school. And that you know, today that's you know, a big deal, but they had a bad time trying to fill all the all the positions in the military that they had, and there's so many people that wanted to go, and they many of them did. So there's a lot of places in the U.S. that had very acute shortage of males, and with the women filled in very nicely. It was just a tough time for everybody.
So you ended up with a job you liked a little bit, and then the government had to come and draft you, huh?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I had a job with Minneapolis Honeywell. They make gauges and that kind of thing. And we made, on the part that I was working on, was the tank periscopes. And we put them together and spot welded them and set them all up to be put in tanks.
Well, and so many people were working, doing something that had some kind of connection to the war. So even though you weren't in the service yet, I bet you had some sense of pride or feeling like you were contributing to the effort in helping put those together.
Oh, yes, I did. We had a nice group of people. I enjoyed them very much. In fact, one of the girls that worked there, her and I went out many times together, and continued our relationship through most of the war. I'm a very poor writer. I don't like to write. It just drives me nuts. I can't think of it. So I didn't write, and she didn't appreciate that at all. Kind of let it slide, more or less. She had a boyfriend that was already in the service at the time.
Well, there would be other plans for you, as you know now. But in terms of Uncle Sam's plans for you, when you got drafted, how big of a shock to your system was that? Or was it something you'd been anticipating and you were ready for?
Yeah, I wanted to go. So I signed up for the paratroops, and I had to have my parent's signature. And I talked my dad into it. My mother wasn't happy with that at all. I signed up for the paratroops and waited, I guess about 2 weeks at Fort Snelling till they had a component of people that were going to Camp Tocoa in Georgia. And we went down there and they got an introduction into the service. Then we got up every morning at 5 o'clock, and we ran up a mountain 2.5 miles and ran down the mountain 2.5 miles. And that's tough to do.
Yeah, that'll get you in shape in a hurry, and I'm sure it did. When did you realize you weren't going to be a paratrooper and that the Army had other ideas for you and other tasks for you to fulfill?
It was about a month, I would guess. I'm not really sure on that, but about a month we were told, some of us were told, that you're going to be transferred. And that group that were transferred, all went into the anti-aircraft. And we had a pretty much of a train load going across the United States to Camp Hahn, California. And we had, we must have had, a couple of hundred people in that group.
And at the time, was that a disappointment to you that you weren't going to be able to be a paratrooper? Or were you relieved? How did you take that news?
Yeah, I was disappointed. They asked us a bunch of questions, and you had to make the right answer, and I guess I didn't have the right answer, and me and a couple of hundred other guys didn't, and they just were not accepted. So they transferred us to the AAA, and all of us made it through that okay. But I was really disappointed. I wanted to be a paratrooper.
So you were disappointed then. How do you feel about it now when you look back with the lens of hindsight and history and see some of the places that those paratroopers went in, like Normandy in June of 44? How do you feel about that fact now?
Well, I'm extremely lucky. My unit went into southern France and had a terrible time. It was a 514th Parachute Infantry, and they got kicked around quite badly, and then after they got southern France, they went into the France and Belgium and that area, and they had a really, really bad time.
Not that the place you did end up was a picnic, but we'll get to that. So now you're in an anti-aircraft unit. What kind of training are you getting, and what are your expectations of what you're going to be doing eventually?
Well, I had absolutely no idea what they expected of me until they told me that. After we got through the basic training, we went to advanced training. And then we started using the things that we needed, like the guns and the searchlights and all that type of thing. And it was an interesting area that I had no idea about.
When people hear an anti-aircraft battalion, I think their mind goes to guns and guns capable of knocking some planes out of the sky. But it's a lot more than just a guy on a gun that goes into an anti-aircraft battalion. What were the jobs that you were trained to perform, and how did you feel about that?
Well, I was trained as a radio operator, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed that. That was an interesting thing to do. And then we also had a work with communication and wire and switchboards and that type of thing, and doing the communication with the wire. You had to climb poles and trees and all that and put the line up there, or you have to bury it, one or the other. And we learned how to do that, and we did that for, the better part of half a year, I guess it was. And by that time, we pretty much had it down pat, and we had training exercise where they fly planes over us and trailing a sock out the back, and it would shoot that sock. We call it a sock, but it's a sleeve of cotton or something, some similar like that. And they could see the holes in the material after they come down, and they'd tell us how we did and so on.
So you're training to be a radio operator, but you also have to know how to operate these guns and get fairly proficient at actually hitting a moving target in the sky.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we had to do that. And we had to train with our rifles also, and we went out in maneuvers and just for basic types of things, And we're secondary infantry is the way they explained it, but I'm glad I didn't have to prove it too often.
Well, you would have to prove something eventually, and we're going to talk about that. Right now, we're going to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about how our guest today, Lewis Davis, ended up on Iwo Jima. Had he ever heard of it before? What did he expect when he went there? And what did he encounter once he did go upon those volcanic ashy shores there in the Pacific? We're going to hear about it from Lewis Davis next. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you'd like to see a photo of our guest today, Lou Davis of Clovis, California, go to our website, kmjnow.com. You can see what he looks like now and what he looked like during World War II, the young man from Minnesota who would get plenty of tan in the Pacific by the time he was done in the U.S. Army, serving in an anti-aircraft battalion in the Pacific, eventually working with some good old U.S. Marines. But let's talk about when you got the news that you were going to ship out. Is that something you'd been waiting for a while? Had you gotten a little antsy with all that training?
Yeah, very definitely. The Army is, work and wait. And we did more waiting than anything else, it seemed like. Well, we finished our training, and then they had us go through our different procedures to that, so we knew what we were going to do and all that, and how to get on a boat and how to get off a boat and that kind of thing. They had us keep active so that we didn't get too lazy and that kind of thing. All our equipment, we had to put Cosmoline on it so that you'd be protected from the salt in the ocean. It's a doozy to get off, I'll tell you. then we finally got the word that we were going to go overseas, and we went in down to the depot, and they had this sign over the depot that said, "Through these portals pass the best damn soldiers in the world." And they didn't put us through there. They didn't put us around it. I felt offended.
I don't blame you. Makes you wonder who's going through that one, huh?
Yeah, I guess it was a different group than us, that's for sure. So we got on a ferry boat, went down the river to San Francisco Harbor, and there we went from the ferry boat into a big ship. And it was the General OS Esquire, and it had seen better days. And we took off under the Golden Gate, and we got out just beyond the Golden Gate, and we got those ground swells. And they popped that ship around like it was a cork. And so many guys got ill. Luckily, I didn't. But we had many guys hanging on the rail.
How did you avoid it? Was it because you're from the land of 10,000 lakes or what?
I think part of that probably had something to do with it. I didn't have, you know, I've been bounced around on a boat many times, but it was a small boat. This was a big boat. Yeah. And it was a really interesting experience to watch. They only fed you twice on the boats. They fed you for morning and then the evening, and you didn't get any lunch. And you got in line when you got up in the morning, and you stayed in line until you got fed, and then you walked out, and you got in the line again, and you stayed in that line until you got fed in the evening. So it was not terribly exciting.
And did you have any idea whatsoever where you were headed?
Absolutely none, until we got out about 2 days, I guess it was, and then they told us we were going to go to Hawaii. And we went to Hawaii, and that was good. I mean, everybody had let out a sigh of relief. They wanted Hawaii. We went to Camp Stoneman, I believe it was, on the island of Oahu, and we were billeted there for 4 or 5 months, and we did some more training.
Tough life in the Army. Boy from Minnesota is forced to spend 4 or 5 months in Hawaii. That must have just been devastating for you.
Yeah. I couldn't hardly stop screaming. It was so interesting and so nice that the weather there is unbelievably good. We were able to go into Honolulu and go to shows and that kind of thing. And of course, we drank a little bit too. But it was an absolutely great experience. And at one point, I was in a when we finally broke from Stoneman, we went out on areas where we would actually practice the thing that we were supposed to do. So I was on a switchboard, and I stayed on that switchboard for 4 hours, and then you'd be relieved for 4 hours, and then be back on for 4 hours. And I was probably 30 feet from the beach, and that's tough duty, I tell you.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it almost seems like some days you might have felt a little guilty for having such a good time when you knew guys were out there getting shot and getting wounded.
Yes, absolutely true. Yeah, we in fact, all of us felt that pretty much that way. They're saying, thank God we're here, and they're there, and they're doing a good job and that kind of thing. But we enjoyed our stay there very much.
Sounds like with all that time preparing that you must have been pretty prepared by the time you actually were deployed to a war zone in the Pacific. Did you feel like you were ready?
Yes, I certainly did. I mean, the Army, tends to overdo anything. That they're training-wise, and they do it, and they do it, and they do it, and they keep on repeating it. So after a while, that gets kind of boring. And we had people that, they didn't want to be that. They volunteered to go into the infantry or whatever,
So tell me about Iwo Jima. When you found out that's where you were headed, I'm sure you'd never heard of the place before. Do you remember the first time you heard Iwo Jima is where we're headed and the first idea you had of what this place might be?
Well, we were on board ship and we were sailing from Hawaii, and we stopped at Inuitok, and we stayed there for a while to refuel or replenish the supplies or whatever it was. And then we took off from there, and we got out in about 3 days. And then they told us this boat is going to Iwo Jima. And the island had just been invaded at that time. And so everybody, put their 10 cents worth of knowledge about Iwo Jima, which was absolutely zero. And we speculated about how bad it was or how good it was and that kind of thing, but we just didn't have any knowledge about Iwo at all. And they would periodically update what the invasion was, what happened when they captured Mount Suribachi, and that kind of thing. And so when we went in, we had no idea what was going to happen or nothing. We We got on our half tracks and boats, and landing ships. For a while there, they had no reason for us to be there. A guy on the shore said they didn't think that we were supposed to be there. And that was a shocker. It really was. They got it straight after several hours. They finally got it straight. They brought us to an area that we camped in for about 2 days. And then we went to our designated areas for setting up our guns and lights and so on.
You talked about hearing early reports of the invasion. You'd probably seen the iconic photo of the flag on top of Mount Suribachi before you actually got to the island, huh?
I don't believe I saw it. I don't think they had that on board ship. I don't think. I don't remember it, at least. But I remember hearing of it, for sure. It was a really thrilling piece of photography and workmanship, I guess, because they did a beautiful job of promoting that. And the people that were involved were, apparently there were several groups involved, which we didn't find out about until several years after the war was over. It must have been there for about 2 weeks or something like that. And then we had a night attack by the Japanese, and they came through the front lines. I don't know how they did it, but they did it. And they started in a unit that was just north of us. It was a transportation unit. They really got shot up bad. But by the time they got to us, I guess they used most of their ammo, because they didn't do much to us at all. They pretty much left us alone. We had some guys come in from headquarters area and tell us that we'd been shot up a little bit, but they went through us and down into the Seabees area, and they were just getting breakfast, and there was one or two cooks in the mess hall getting the breakfast, and the Japanese walked in and shot them both. We were near the area where the Japanese had come through, but we somehow or another they missed us. I don't know how they did it, but I thank God for that too.
Yeah, if they're gonna shoot the cook preparing breakfast, they're gonna have no qualms with shooting a radio operator. Tell me about your duties as a radio operator there on a given day on Iwo Jima, and obviously the early stages of this battle, the one that the stuff you see in all the movies with so many Marines suffering casualties and Army replacements suffering casualties, that had passed, and it's a little different scenario on Iwo Jima at that point. But what was your typical day like? What duties were you assigned, and was it hectic? Was it nervous? Was it scary? What was it like?
Well, it was a little beach. We had a position that was west of the airfield, and it was on a slight rise, and just slightly lower than the airfield. And we had a radio, or I had a radio, and we made contact with our CP, and we get messages from them, and we'd send messages back, and that lasted for about 5 or 6 days, as I remember. And then they ran out some wire to us, and it was much, much easier to do the wire. All those radios were subject to variations in volume and station identification and so on. And they have had a lot of guys that weren't able to get their information from the CP to them, and vice versa. But it worked out after a couple of days, and then it was just a very routine type of thing going on. We call in the morning and get our station number, and we had to play with the locator, and that we had to do that every morning, and then it was okay for the rest of the day. And then when the wire came in, it was just a snap. You just sit there and with the phone. And whenever they call it, you ring and answer it, and then tell them whatever they wanted to know, and then you call back and if you need any help or need some equipment or anything like that. So it was a very reasonably easy job.
And your guys' purpose for being there, anti-aircraft unit, how often, if at all, did you actually get to fire at some Japanese aircraft?
Oh yeah, yeah. One night they came in, and we had a good warning. They had some long range radar, and we knew they were coming in. Plus we had some night fighters on the airport, and they went up, and they intercepted them several miles offshore, and but some of them got through, and they bombed the airport. And they blew up a couple of planes at least, because I saw the explosions and the fire afterwards. We shot our number four gun, I believe it was, shot down one of their planes, but we didn't turn on the searchlights, and we should have, but somehow it broke down. I don't know why. It was a touch and go thing because they when they were bombing, you know, they you don't want to turn that light on. If you don't have to, because they can, you know, fire machine guns at it and drop bombs at it and so on. That doesn't help your longevity much.
No, I would think not. Well, I've got a lot of questions after the nuggets that you just shared. Like your number four gun shot down a plane. How many guns did you have in the unit you were with? And as you described, getting advance warning, how did that warning come to you? Was that a message that was relayed through you as the radio operator? Or what role were you playing in the communication that seemed to be pretty crucial at that point?
Well, we got the message from our CP, our headquarters, that we were going to have some Japanese flights coming in. Set up your fence and be ready to fire. And that's what we did. We just everything got all ready. I don't know how many guns now. I don't remember how many there were. Something like eight. You know, I wouldn't swear to that, but something similar to that. All our guns were firing. Yeah, and but the only one that was confirmed was the one that we shot down.
And what are you doing while all this is going on?
I was sitting on the phone, getting messages from the CP and giving him back information. You know what we were doing and how bad we. We're doing or that kind of thing. Our guns were firing and our searchlights didn't come on, and I understand that. And they wanted to have a more complete idea of what was happening, and so they kept on talking to us. And I trying to listen to them, and then those guns are going off. It's awfully difficult to do.
You have to ask them to repeat themselves a time or two.
Yes. Yes, I had to wring out my socks. I mean,
I don't blame you. And I certainly don't want to compare anything I do to what you were doing in that situation, but it kind of struck me. My day job is a play-by-play announcer for football and basketball and baseball games, and it strikes me that that's kind of what you were doing in that moment. You had to give a play-by-play, a blow-by-blow, as descriptive as possible back to that command post so they knew whether you needed reinforcements or just the progress. Is that what it felt like to you, just full speed, trying to keep up with everything flashing around you?
Yeah, pretty much that way. I was more than a little nervous, I tell you. And that was the only real night raid we had. I mean, that's the only aircraft raid we had. So we didn't get a chance to really function well. You know, it always takes a little time to work the knots out of the thing.
And what kind of shelter did you have where you were, and how close did some of the fire from the Japanese planes come to you?
Wide open. I was in wide open spaces, and standing there talking on the phone, and it had a three-way switch. In one way, you could listen to the CP, and you put the same switch, and you put it in a different position, and you could talk to the guns, and another switch, you could put it and talk to the lights. And you I only had about 10 seconds to learn this. So we didn't do too well.
Sounds like any one of those military acronyms would apply here, like the snafu. So this sounds like a little bit of a panic set in for you.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I was definitely in the panic. You know, I didn't have any time to prepare for that part of the training. You know, I just never had any. That's normally the senior NCO, which is a sergeant. He normally does that, but he decided he wanted to be on the machine gun, so he hopped over some sandbags we had around the machine gun, and he stood there and waited for the signal for him to start firing. But the planes were far too high for him, because he only had a 50 caliber machine gun, and they will go pretty high, but it's awfully difficult to shoot anything like a machine gun into that high as they were.
And if they're trying to bomb the airfield, and you're right next to the airfield, the bombs were how close to you?
I suppose about a block, about a city block. When those bombs started going off and the plane started burning, and you're so involved with that there right now, you know, and then they're trying to talk to you, and you're trying to talk to them, and it's really a tough thing.
Boy, it sounds like it, especially for a kid who had just turned 21 at the time. We need to catch another break, but when we come back, what else did Lou Davis experience on Iwo Jima, and what has this World War II veteran done with the rest of his life? What did he do for more than three decades to help other veterans? The home stretch of Hometown Heroes is straight ahead on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off, 87-year-old Lou Davis was describing the chaos of a nighttime attack by Japanese aircraft on Iwo Jima. After that incident, he and other anti-aircraft personnel were moved to another post on the island. Where'd they send you, Lou?
From right beside the airport, pretty much, to the top of Mount Suribachi. And I spend the rest of my time in Iwo on top of Mount Suribachi.
Really? That must have been interesting. What were you doing up there?
It's the same thing. It's just the same unit. We had the same type of duties, pretty much. But they wanted to keep grouped together, pretty much, because it's the only thing that we really knew how to do, you know. So they just switched us around some and see if that would help. But we never had any more air attacks from then on in.
I imagine from on top of Mount Suribachi, you had a pretty interesting view. What could you see from up there?
You could see the whole island. The island is only about 2.5 miles long, something like that. And you could see everything. And that's where the Marines took put the flag on Mount Suribachi. When I got there, one of the things that they showed me, the Seabees made a road up Mount Suribachi in 4 days. And the Japanese had been working on it for 5 years. So the Seabees really shone. They really did.
So that made it easier to get to where you were up there. And I know that the story of the flag raising, there was a first flag and then there was a second flag that was bigger because Secretary Forrestal didn't think it looked big enough and all of that. But was there still a flag flying up there while you manned your post on top of the mountain?
No, they'd taken that down or walked off from it, yeah. The only thing that we had up there that was a depth charge. A huge, it must have been 3 foot long and about a foot in diameter depth charge that the Japanese had placed on the side of this mountain, Mount Suribachi, on the southwest side of Mount Suribachi, and it's out right near the top. And the idea was apparently to anybody that came try to get up Mount Suribachi from that side, they'd just explode that and all the mountain would just kind of fall down on them, you know.
So that must have not been too comforting to see that sitting there, knowing that it could be potentially detonated.
Yes, I remember that. And but after a while, we just lived right next to it, so we didn't think that much about it.
Iwo Jima is, of course, legendary for the network of tunnels and caves that the Japanese had dug in there. Did you get to witness any of that and get a taste for how complex that system was?
Well, yeah, we were first assigned to the north end of the island, and there's a lot of ravines up there at the north end, and it's a baked clay that they have, and they had dozens of caves up there. I mean, they'd come in at night and come out at night, the Japanese would, from these caves, and then fire on us or anybody that happened to be around. I guess they were finally disseminated enough so that they didn't bother us anymore. I think they got something like 100 prisoners out of that, but they killed something like 2,000 or 3,000.
Yeah, all but a few fought to the death on that island. But I'm curious, when you think about the nighttime attacks on the ground where they'd infiltrate your camps and try to kill people, and knowing that all these tunnels and caves are there, was it a sense of never quite believing that they all were rooted out because you knew they could be hiding somewhere inside that island?
Yeah, definitely. You know, after they had that, we had that attack, it was particularly nerve-wracking to think about, you know, they're, we may be coming down here again and that kind of thing. But they never did. I think that was their last hurrah, more or less. And they didn't either have the personnel or the equipment or whatever to do it again. They had lots and lots of tunnels and caves and that kind of thing all over that north end of the island. They even had some on Mount Suribachi, but they were pretty well taken off.
You didn't try to explore any of them, were you? I'm sure the booby trap scare would be enough to keep you out of those caves.
Well, that's a little bit embarrassing. A couple of us decided that we wanted to take a look and see what those caves looked like. And we went into, there was three or four of us, I can't remember exactly how many there were. And we went into one of these caves, and of course there's no light in there. And we didn't have any flashlights. We just kind of blunder around a little bit and we hoped that our eyes would get used to the darkness. One guy had his rifle in kind of like an port arms position, and he snagged a dead Japanese guy that was on a little platform or a little indentation. The Japanese guy fell down on his foot. And you never seen four guys come so fast in your life. I mean, we moved. We flew out of that thing.
Because it's in the dark and you don't know what it is and you think maybe.
Yeah, I just know that there's something wrong, big wrong.
So you thought you may have set off a booby trap.
Yeah, that and we didn't know if he's alive or dead, really, you know.
And you didn't stick around to find out?
No, indeed. You know, as far as I know, it's still there.
And how many more times after that did you venture into a dark cave?
That was the first and last. I figured that was enough.
Surprise, surprise. You know, in thinking of some of the other images that I've seen of Iwo Jima, there's some very striking pictures of crosses in the cemetery on Iwo Jima. And not just the casualties that the Japanese suffered there, but the scores of Americans who gave their lives on that island. Did you ever see any of the graves on the island, the cemeteries, the makeshift cemeteries that were built there? And if so, what did that mean to you to get a glimpse of that?
Yeah, I saw. As a matter of fact, I had I got onto a detail working as an assistant on the backhoe, and they dig down and try to get graves for the different. Well, it happened to be Japanese at that area. But they had so many. The backhoe guy was from the Seabees, and we were helping them more or less. But it was there's so many dead people, Marines and Japs. It's unbelievable. I mean, they just had hundreds of them, and it all happened very quickly. I mean, it was within a couple of weeks that all the fighting was done, pretty much.
So you're helping the guy on the backhoe, and you're basically turning up whatever dirt you can and then piling a bunch of bodies in a trench? I mean, is that how it worked, or how would you describe it?
Well, yeah, that's the kind of thing we were doing. We put them all in a trench, and then they had a grave detail. They come around and try to identify who it was and that kind of thing. A lot of Japanese that were, we knew nothing about them at all. We put them in a mass grave, more or less.
How did that impact you, just as a human being, to see that much carnage, to realize that somebody has to clean up after this, and realize that the price that was paid on that island, is that something that weighed heavily on still a teenager from Minnesota?
Yeah, I thought it was, terrible. All the bodies and their in the condition they were in. I remember thinking it was just, a horrible, horrible waste. And about that time, I contracted pneumonia or a very bad cold, I don't know which, but anyway, they put me in the hospital on Iwo Jima. And I stayed there for 4 or 5 days, but they had the sulfa drugs that had cleared up the pneumonia beautifully.
And after seeing the aftermath of that battle and seeing like you said, the price that was paid there, did it make you hope that the war was about over? Did you have an inkling that the war was coming to a close? What was your concept of that?
Well, I certainly hoped it would, but I didn't have any idea of when it would end. Okinawa was going to happen very shortly. We were still on Iwo Jima at the time of Okinawa, and that turned into a bloody battle.
Yeah, I'm sure you're glad you didn't have to go there. Where were you when you heard about these new weapons that had been used against Japan and a pretty sure sign that the war was about to end? Do you remember where you heard that?
Yeah, we had radio. They told us, you know, that they had dropped a special kind of a bomb, and it didn't really sink in that was going to be the end of the war. But the second one, that did it. We all felt that was going to be the end of the war right there.
Was there any special celebration on Iwo Jima after that news came?
Well, as almost always, you know, there's going to be some guys that's going to overdo. And some of the guys took machine guns, you know, and just shot up into the air like you see some of the Arabs doing now. And we just shooting up in the air, and you could see the tracers going up in the air and going all over the place, you know. And, of course, they put in the MPs, and they quieted that down real quickly.
So I imagine it was occurring to you that you were going to get to go home before too long.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you had those points systems, you know, and you had, as I remember, I had 50 points, and that was about 3 or 4 or 5 months into the peace area. And then there must have been several thousand on board that U.S. Bunker Hill. I don't think we stopped anywhere. We just went right straight into Los Angeles Harbor. And we had steak, and we had baked potatoes, but most of all, we had fresh milk. That was so good. You can't believe how good that fresh milk tasted. Just delicious. Because otherwise, we had that powdered stuff, you know. And that was, you know, it worked, but I mean, nothing to write home about. And it was just so good. And I had a whole quart of milk myself. I drank that. I'd empty that whole bottle.
It had been a long time since you'd had any of that. Well, I'm sure you remember what it was like to make it way back, your way back to Minnesota and see your family again. What do you remember about that?
And I called my folks and I said, okay, I'm, they discharged me. I'm going to get on the train in such a time, and I'll be home about, you know, noon. And so I got on the train, and it's just I think it's about 4 hours or 5 hours from Camp McCoy to Minneapolis. And my folks come down and pick me up. And boy, I talk about a reunion. You know, it was so good. I seen my dad and my mother, you know, just absolutely wonderful. Yeah, I'll never forget that feeling if I live to be a million.
I'm sure you shared some of what you did with them. And did they tell you any stories about what they did while you were overseas? I mean, had they written you letters? Were they praying for you? Did you hear any of those kind of stories?
Yeah, well, my mother sent fudge about every month. She'd send me a batch of fudge, and it was so good. Just so good.
I'm surprised the fudge got through. Did you have to share with your buddies? Was there a fudge tax?
Oh, yeah. They'd all stand around. Well, you know, mail call. Everybody stands around and waits for the guy to give you a letter. My mother would send it in a little box, and the guys would watch, you know. Lou's got candy, and I go in the tent, you know, and wrap it, you know, and they all stand there and look at me. So I take about 3 or 4 pieces and then let them have the rest.
Wow, what a guy. Looking back after all the years, and I'm sure you had a different perspective then than the time has given you in all the years past. When you think about what you did and what all the guys you served with did in World War II, why do you think it's important for us to remember it today? What do you think we should remember, and what stands out the most to you?
Well, a lot of men died, and a lot of women too, as far as that goes. And a lot of them were severely wounded, and many of them, you know, are still, you know, having problems. The majority of us kind of did some self-medication with alcohol to release all the emotions involved. About every Saturday or Sunday night, you could find most of us in a bar talking old war stories, I think people are really understand that the stuff that we went through, and not me so much, is because I had it relatively easy, but so many of them had just terrible time. And strangely enough, just a short time ago, I was wearing a hat that had World War II vet on the front of it, and a guy walks up to me and he says, "Are you from World War II?" And I says, "Yes." And he said, "Where were you?" And I said, "I was in the Central Pacific. Were you with Jima?" And he says, "I'll buy you a drink." And so I said, "Well, okay, I'll do that." And so he hands me he asked me what I wanted. I said, "A glass of wine." Then I was just finishing my meal. And he says, "Let me see that tab." And I hand him the bill, and he says, "It's on me." That's the first time that anybody ever already said, thank you.
Well, let me be the second to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you as well for serving so many other veterans in a very valuable way. One of the reasons Lou could speak on how veterans coped with what they experienced is that he spent 30 years working as a psychiatric nurse with the Veterans Administration in Los Angeles. He finally retired with the rank of colonel. So, Lou, we salute you today. Have a wonderful 4th of July. And for you at home, as you celebrate this Independence Day, don't forget to thank the people you know who have helped keep our great nation free. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.